Welcome to our California Counts Town Hall from the historic Guild Theater in Sacramento. I'm Beth Ruyak from Capital Public Radio. Where did the U.S. movement to legalize marijuana begin? Most people agree it happened here in the Golden State. California, though, wasn't the first state to decriminalize cannabis. It was the first state to legalize medical marijuana, and that happened with the passage of Prop 215 in 1996. Legalizing weed recreationally, though, that's been a bigger challenge. Colorado has done it, Oregon too, Alaska, Washington, and the District of Columbia. Will California be next? Or will the state again say no, like voters did here in 2010 with the effort known as Prop 19? We're going to hear from voters in our audience and a panel of experts who are each involved in the cannabis community at various levels. First of all, though, I'd like to introduce my co-host here from KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, and the host of Air Talk, Mr. Larry Mantle.
Beth, great to be working with you. Thank you so much. Great to take part in these programs looking at the November election up and down the state. Well, let's begin with Prop 64 with Rich Maddich. He represents the 64 campaign. He's an attorney here in Sacramento. Rich, you're responsible for drafting the language of Prop 64. How would marijuana be treated differently under this than under the current Prop 215 medical marijuana standards?
Well, actually, we use the existing structure that the governor recently signed into law as the template for non-medical marijuana. Same regulatory agencies. We would control, regulate, tax marijuana under a very similar structure. We'd have some of the strongest protections for children in the nation. We ban advertising towards children. We ban the production of edibles, which could be appealing to children. We provide very robust regulatory provisions to provide regulators with the flexibility to adapt to non-medical marijuana. We tax non-medical marijuana, creating a revenue source to address things like remediation of environmental damage that has occurred due to illegal grows.
So you feel like it's there's not a lot left for the legislature to do if this passes?
We think this is the most comprehensive marijuana legalization measure in the nation, but it was important to us. It was critical. This is one of the lessons from the Blue Ribbon Commission. You still have to provide flexibility for the legislature to adjust things in the future. And so, unlike a lot of initiatives, we provide that flexibility to the legislature. And frankly, we also provide complete local control on this issue as well. So local governments have flexibility as well.
All that said, when you talk about local control, you're dealing with police chiefs, you're dealing with law enforcement. And let me bring in Lauren Michaels, who is with the California Police Chiefs Association. She's with the No campaign. Lauren, Gallup polls back in 2011 were showing about 50% of Americans in favor of legalization of recreational marijuana. We're now closer to 60%. The number keeps rising. Why no?
Well, I think I agree. We see large public sentiment going towards legalization in favor, and we see those numbers. The question remains, how do you regulate and how do you legalize? We see the 60% for legalization in general, but when we get into the details of the initiative and ask voters, is this the way you want to legalize marijuana, you see those numbers shift. And it's our job to provide information to the voters about our concerns with this initiative and see if this is the way that they want to go.
You mean when it's drilled down to particular points where they have concerns?
Exactly.
That the 60% breaks down.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So can you give a specific example of something in 64 that you think is out of sync with the majority of Californians?
Sure. We look into one of the points in Prop 64 that says that someone who has a felony conviction for narcotics, whether it be sale or possession, cannot be denied a license on those grounds alone. And we ask voters, is this how you want to legalize marijuana?
Can I jump in there? It's actually not quite as broad as what Lauren described. We specifically say that a prior offense for anything involving children, trafficking in drugs, those are disqualifying. And with respect to how the licensing process works, there's no entitlement to a license under Prop 64, and that's the same with medical. And in fact, under medical, if you have a prior conviction for a substance-related offense, you can still get a license under medical at the discretion of the regulatory agency. So it's not that significant of a departure.
Can I just clarify, though, if someone had been arrested for selling even small quantities of marijuana, could they still get a license to sell?
Under the medical system or
under
Prop 64?
No, under the recreational.
Under Prop 64, that would not be automatically
disqualified.
They would not,
because that might disproportionately hit communities of color where People have supported themselves sometimes with even small quantities of marijuana sales.
And in our extensive outreach with stakeholders, that was one of the concerns that we heard with precisely what happened under medical. So we did do it a little bit differently.
I'm going to ask our Sacramento County DA, Anne-Marie Schubert, to jump in, because when this part of the conversation started, you took a big breath and threw your hand up.
Well, I think that one thing that I disagree with Rich about is when he says it absolutely bans advertising to minors. That's actually not true, and that happened in court this week where the court authorized the language in the ballot argument that it could, in fact, promote advertising to minors, that the language of the initiative, the ballot argument, that it could, because we know that sometimes the states are left up to what the advertising is. And so that's a major concern, obviously, from my perspective, both as a parent and a prosecutor, is that, you know, really, what is the good public policy of this other than money?
Well, I think to respond to that, that's actually what the court said was it was absolutely true in our statement. They did not change our statement with respect to the initiative bans advertisements directed to kids. So you can't market to kids. You can't
except for shows like CSI and all those shows that kids watch.
Under federal law, you cannot broadcast marijuana-related advertising on TV. The only way that happens is if federal law changes or if somebody violates federal law. And the judge.
But then this would be the law. If federal law changes, then these provisions of 64 would go into effect.
Because in the absence of having any provisions, forward-looking provisions in Prop 64, which mirror the alcohol prohibitions on when, or not prohibitions, but restrictions on when you can show alcohol ads, there wouldn't be any
but
provisions.
The DA's point is correct, isn't it, that the only ban is on kids-specific programming. Everything else
cartoons
would be fair game.
No, that's still not quite right. The audience, if under Prop 64, if federal law changed, then you could only have marijuana-related advertising on TV if the audience was 71.1% 21 and up.
Pause a moment. Joel, you're in California. You're in Colorado. Joel Warner is a journalist based in Denver. What's happening there with advertisement?
Well, I have to say, in general, we haven't seen that much advertising. We haven't seen the sky falling, as some people suggested, after Colorado legalized marijuana. We haven't seen teen use increase. We haven't seen real serious issues with driving under the influence, but we have seen complications. There is no question that things haven't changed in Colorado, ranging from we've seen corporate consolidation of a lot of the marijuana shops. We've seen worker concerns about not getting the protections they need. We've seen homeless shelters saying they're seeing more and more people coming to Colorado to either get jobs in the industry or use recreationally or medically. And of course, you have the issue of how do you regulate marijuana gummy bears? And then the final question is, I mean, everyone keeps looking at these studies a year or two out, seeing, oh, are we seeing more ER visits? But the issue is, what are we going to see 10 years, 20 years down the road? When the first generation that has grown up with legal marijuana, what are we going to see in these long-term, widespread social factors? We don't know.
Wait, where's the information saying that teen use isn't up or some of these statistics? I would like to know, because not only did you react, but Peter Heck, too. Peter?
Well,
Joel?
I'm not a specific expert in Colorado, but my understanding from national drug abuse statistics, Colorado has traditionally ranked very high for cannabis use. And if you look at the national survey data, and there's not been a significant drop since 2009 until now, for that matter, a significant increase. And in fact, in the last year, the Colorado Department of Health reported a very, very modest drop in teenage marijuana use. I would probably consider to be statistically insignificant. But this is a state where there was always a high level of cannabis use.
What didn't happen then is the reverse.
It didn't
use
seem to
didn't
explode.
Spike.
And obviously you have a great deal of pot-savoring tourists who are coming into town. I mean, that's one real dimension of recreational marijuana that largely does not exist with medical marijuana. Right now in California, it's not legal to come in from another state and purchase medical marijuana. Some other states do have agreements where you can take your physician's recommendation or a card from another state. California does not. So the real dimension is are people coming for Disneyland and Yosemite going to be stopping at their dispensaries while they're here?
By the way, Peter Hecht, who is Sacramento Bee, a reporter who covers the marijuana industry. Let's hear from a listener who recorded this question. We'll take the answer from our panel.
My name is Kevin Rahm, and I live in Sacramento, California. And as a father, I'm concerned about keeping pot out of the hands of kids, especially edibles. What child protections are in the measure?
Kimberly Cargile at Sacramento-based Medical Marijuana Dispensary, a therapeutic alternative. She's on the board of the California Growers Association. Is Kimberly, you want to take that on?
Yeah, so Proposition 64's first priority is protecting our children. It's of a top concern. It's a top concern of mine. I'm a mother. And there's a variety of protections for children that are written into this initiative. First is childproof packaging, clear labeling, no advertising to children, packaging that can't be seen through, products cannot be focused on children. And it also goes deeper. It goes deeper into the social justice issues of, you know, one of the most dangerous things about marijuana, it's a non-toxic drug. It's not going to kill our children like many pharmaceuticals and alcohol will. But one of the most dangerous things about it is that a child can be arrested and can be denied financial aid and that denied the ability to go to college and better their lives. So it absolutely thinks about our children, our young children, and our future generations who are going to grow up in this state.
Well, I wanted to ask, though, because the language in this, doesn't it say that no agency can require anything unreasonably impracticable of the industry? And, I mean, couldn't that come into the how something is packaged, how,
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, to go back to what types of child protections to be responsive to the question, you know, we absolutely prohibit the manufacture of edibles, and this is a lesson we actually learned from Colorado and other states, that can either be appealing to kids or we could be easily confused with commercially made candies.
Couldn't
or
any
other
edible, though, be appealing to kids?
No, I think that, well, the point is that it's either appealing to kids or it could be easily confused. Both types are actually prohibited from being manufactured under Prop 64. The unreasonably impracticable language has to be read, I think, in light of the other provisions of the initiative, which say that is intended to ensure that the regulations allow for the establishment of a regulated market. They can't be so strict as to not have a regulated market.
We can come back to that goal. D.A. Schubert, quick comment. We got about 20 seconds.
My quick comment is, if we're really about the top priorities, kids, then why are we allowing 97% THC content in marijuana in California?
All right, we're coming your way from the Guild Theater in Sacramento. This is California Counts, a statewide program in which we're bringing together an audience here in our state's capital to talk with our panel about Proposition 64, which would legalize recreational marijuana right here in the Golden State. We'll be back with more conversation right after this.
Welcome back to California Counts, the pros and cons of legalizing recreational marijuana. I'm Beth Ruriak of Capital Public Radio, here with Larry Mantle of KPCC Los Angeles. We're at the Guild Theater in Sacramento, and we're exploring Prop 64, which officially is the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, and it will be on the November ballot in California statewide. We left off with a rather provocative comment from the Sacramento County DA about the level of THC in marijuana. And I want to explore from different people on the panel about THC levels. Kimberly Cargile, maybe I'll ask that question first of you, even though you're dealing with a medical dispensary. Talk about THC levels.
Well, absolutely. So within cannabis, there's a variety of different cannabinoids, which are the active ingredients in cannabis. THC is only one of them. And I think what you're talking about is a manufactured substance. So cannabis doesn't naturally grow up to 97% or 99% or whatever it was you said. That's actually used through a manufacturing process. And it is manufactured to take the active ingredients away from the plant matter as to help those ingest cannabis that don't want to smoke it, and also to be able to specifically find the exact milligrams and put a specific amount of milligrams. I think we're capping it at 10 milligrams per edible in Proposition 64. So that way patients know exactly how much is in there. So it's a matter of processing it, and we lab test it to find out the milligrams, but it's related to a percentage.
And is that per individual item sold, or could you have a candy bar, for example, that says it has 6 servings and have 60 milligrams total?
I think it's per serving size.
Rich?
So yes. You have to hope that the person who's eating the candy bar has restraint not to eat beyond the limit, right?
No, you know? Actually, that there is education that's required. So every person...
Of whom?
Education for the consumers. So the people who are selling these products, I believe, are going to need to be educated. We do weekly education with our staff. Because every person has a different tolerance and is going to be able to use a different amount of cannabis. My personal dosage is 10 milligrams. However, my assistant, who's 100 pounds, her dosage is 100 milligrams. So every person is going to have a variety of a number of variables that is going to determine their specific milligrams that they need. So absolutely, it is important to have manufactured products and to have labeled products and have lab-tested products so that we can use the correct amount for ourselves.
Kimberly, can I have Peter jump in here? Because you've spent enough time in Colorado, and Joel, you may weigh in on this as well, and someone walks in and walks out, and the regulation or the control stops at the door as it closes mm-hmm. behind them. Mm-hmm.
Well, the one good thing that you're generally going to get with the dispensary, particularly some of the better ones in California, and soon this is going to be required both under legislation signed by Jerry Brown and as well as under the initiative, is you're going to get generally product testing for THC for the less the non-psychoactive ingredient called cannabidiol or CBD, and as well as molds and pesticides and things like that. But when you're talking about THC, there is this sort of common mantra, particularly put out by some of the law enforcement industries, that marijuana is so much more potent. And on one level, that is true. And you have this very sophisticated plant breeding and so forth. But when you walk into a dispensary, it's particularly a medical marijuana dispensary, it's almost kind of a 31 flavors. So older people may not want really amped up stuff. You may get 10, 15% THC, which is toward the lower end. The highest end of more regular marijuana may be 27, 28, in extreme cases, 29%. I'm not really that familiar with concentrates,
Joel,
but...
How often do you see 97%?
I don't think we've ever seen 97%, but these marijuana concentrates or dabs are increasingly common. So if you go to a lot of these marijuana shops in Denver and beyond, more and more of the selection is away from the flower and more to these kind of sticky kind of dabs. And yes, it looks kind of bad. It looks almost like you're freebasing marijuana.
Right.
To me, what's fascinating though is that that hasn't been the big problem in Colorado. It has been these cookies and candy bars. And that kind of goes to the fact that you can stick all these regulations and testing onto these products, but the thing is, we don't have the decades of social education that we have with alcohol, where we know the difference with having one glass of wine with dinner and having 4 shots of Jim Beam at a bar. We don't know that as a society yet for marijuana. So when you go to one of these shops and the butt tender says, as they are trained to do, have 1/10 of this candy bar and wait 2 hours. Who does that, right? I mean, we're trying to put pharmaceutical concepts on something that we see as a pure just indulgence. And so it's hard for us to compute these things, even with all of the training and all the regulations.
D.A. Schubert, quick comment?
The quick comment is that one failure of this initiative is that there is no per se limit on driving with marijuana in your system, and that's a real problem.
We'll get to that question a little bit later. Let's hear from another one of our listeners who has another question for our panel.
Hi, my name is Chantal, and I'm from Burbank, California. I'm wondering where the tax on marijuana money will go and how would it be used?
Rich?
Well, 60% of the, well, back up, actually, the first call on the tax revenues is to support the regulatory structure, to ensure that we have robust enforcement of the structure that we've put in place. We then actually devote a substantial amount of money, $3 million annually over 3 years, to the CHP and to law enforcement to develop protocols and standards to detect driving under the influence, impaired driving. And we actually reached out and worked closely with the CHP on those provisions. And there are studies that say that a per se standard doesn't work. What you need is you need more training, more officers to be able to detect impaired driving. It's about training, it's about protocols. There just isn't the technology because of the way THC metabolizes in a system to use a per se standard.
Can we quickly just define per se meaning a specific level of THC in the blood?
That's exactly right. So the studies, and I believe the AAA study actually reinforces this, what we really need, the most effective way to deal with impaired driving is more training, more officers, and the initiative funds that. The initiative then sends 60% of the revenues to youth education, prevention, and treatment. You know, kids who don't have after-school programs get into trouble with drugs. This is not a surprise. So we fund those types of programs. Youth homelessness is a problem often associated with all manner of drug use. We provide funding for those types of programs.
Any of this go to the general fund or all the specifically designated funds?
No, this goes to specific purposes. And this was another lesson that we learned from the Blue Ribbon Commission. We can't treat this like California's next gold rush. We have to be smart with how we use those revenues. So the second piece of this, after the youth education, prevention, and treatment, goes to environmental restoration and prevention from the harm that was caused by illegal grows. And then finally, the remaining 20%, which, by the way, the legislative analyst, this is an hour number, says that this could generate up to $1 billion annually when fully implemented. So $200 million annually goes to local law enforcement for grants.
Joel, can I ask you how the projections have compared to the realities in tax revenue in Colorado?
I think it has been more than projected. The issue is how long will these revenues last? As more states begin to legalize, I mean, is Colorado going to continue to see these increased revenues, or is it all going to spread out?
And was there a concern in Colorado about the funding for the state being based on what's called a sin tax and this being a sin tax?
I think this concept of marijuana sin taxes is now being developed as we're seeing more states and more municipalities say, well, let's actually use some of this money to address homeless issues, or let's use some of this money to address communities who have been harmed unduly thanks to the war on drugs. Now we're starting to see this, like whether or not marijuana revenue should be used. And you know, the argument is, yes, if you increase these taxes, is the price going to become so prohibitive to buy this stuff that folks are going to go back to the black market and legalization becomes a moot point?
You raised criminal justice system. Let's hear a question from one of our listeners along those lines.
Hi, my name is Cliff from North Hollywood. Has the criminalization of marijuana resulted in Californians being jailed? If so, how many people are currently in jail in California for crimes relating to marijuana use and possession? Would this new legislation put a stop to that? Also, what kind of effect will this new law have on Mexican drug cartels? Thanks for answering my question.
Sacramento County DA Anne-Marie Schubert, you want to answer?
I want to tell you that there's not a single person in prison that for possession of marijuana. We don't put people in prison for possessing marijuana. You can ask the Department of Corrections. In Sacramento County, for anybody that wants to know, if you possess less than an ounce of marijuana, it's a $60 ticket. It's less than a ticket for speeding.
But for those who have larger quantities, with the presumption that they're probably looking to sell it,
we charge possession for sale when there's evidence they're selling. So it's not just simple possession.
But not just holding of a large quantity.
Well, there may be other indications, whether they have scales, whether they have payo sheets, other things that would indicate that they're selling drugs. So
will a change in the law, though, if 64 is passed, prompt a revisiting of some states in the case and a resentencing or perhaps a dropping of charges?
Well, they're not going to be resentenced on possession of marijuana because nobody's in prison for possession of marijuana. Well, that's just not the case. People are in prison because they've either done a violent crime with a bad record or they've sold drugs and they have a bad record.
Lauren, I know you want to get in here too, but Rich, jump in there.
Well, I would just point out that the Legislative Analyst's Office, again, independent source, estimated that up to $10 million annually in saved law enforcement costs because of the decriminalization provisions in the initiative. So clearly, somebody's in jail. Somebody's being tracked
by probation
officers.
That's not true. That's just not true.
Well, the Legislative Analyst says that it is true, and it's their job to provide true information to
the voters. Maybe for writing the tickets. Maybe for writing the tickets.
You were listening to Rich Maddich, who is an attorney and drafted much of the language in Prop 64. Also discussing that point with him was Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert. I would like Lauren Michaels' voice in this conversation representing the Police Chiefs Association. And not only on this point, but going back to that issue of driving under the influence too.
Sure. Well, let's start with this point. You know, what we've seen in other states that have decriminalized and commercialized marijuana, Colorado. We've seen an increase in criminal filings for marijuana increase in Colorado from 1 in 2007 to 40 in 2015. And there seems to be a consensus among law enforcement that unless we see uniform change across the United States, there's still going to be a place for the black market to sell to out of state. And we expect to see that in California. Creating a commercialized and licensed market in California will not bring everyone into compliance. And people who are acting out of compliance with the law can still be penalized and go into...
What would be the incentive for people to purchase on the black market versus purchasing legally?
For people out of state? A lack of legal.
I'm talking about here in California.
Sure. Getting around taxes.
But under the medical marijuana, how it's treated in Prop 64, there's no sales taxes that are paid by those who have the marijuana card. And there are other incentives for people actually allowing you to grow more if you use medical marijuana, allowing you to smoke it in places where people smoke cigarettes. So if people don't want to comply with the recreational side, wouldn't they just get a medical card?
They absolutely could, but still having a medical card, you have to pay that 15% excise tax under Prop 64.
Kimberly, how does your business change if Prop 64 passes?
Well, my particular business, a therapeutic alternative, won't change. However, I most likely will be involved in recreational businesses. But I wanted to speak to the social justice issues. We know people are in jail for cannabis, and even if they aren't in prison, these people, when they are convicted, they're denied future jobs. They're denied financial aid to go to college. It deeply impacts their lives for a nonviolent, victimless crime of having cannabis. So we also need to, you know, spread it out more than just being in prison.
So, but let me just clarify. So you're saying these are people you're talking about who are selling marijuana, who are in jail. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there are a variety of cannabis-related crimes, and when someone's arrested for cannabis, typically they are charged with multiple crimes, right? So if I'm arrested with cannabis, I'm most likely going to be charged with a variety of crimes.
But so then it's not the
They have to go through the system, they have to pay lawyers, they have to have a lot of stress and time to fight those.
But I'm not quite following. So if there are other charges, then how is the cannabis possession relevant?
Well, it's relevant for a number of reasons. It's relevant first for probable cause, for police searching people's homes based on the fact that they have cannabis, searching their cars, searching their persons. We have seen by looking at this issue that there is a disproportionate amount of young men of color who are targeted by police for this specific
issue. But would this change under 64? Because if there's still going to be people who can't get licenses to sell and want to support themselves by selling marijuana, aren't they still exposed to the law?
Well, absolutely. So that's not who I'm talking about. I'm talking about the people who are charged with crimes that they didn't commit, are charged with, are searched by police and targeted by police.
I want to pause here. Why is there such a disconnect on this point? D.A. Schubert,
She's mixing apples and oranges. She's not just talking about simple possession.
Not just her point, but people on this panel are saying there is a perception that people are in jail because of marijuana.
Because they're ill-informed and there's a misrepresentation in the media. One of the things that I want to comment on, which was a comment about disproportionality, if you look at Colorado, you see pot shops in communities that are low income. There's a disproportionate number. And for me, as a parent and as a public safety official, you're not going to see pot shops in Arden Oaks, Sacramento County. You're going to see pot shops in areas that communities want to thrive in, where we want jobs, we want kids to thrive in and play in their neighborhoods. Instead, what they're going to be doing is walking past liquor stores and pot shops. There are twice as many pot shops in Colorado as there are Starbucks.
But could part of that be, please, audience members, you'll have a chance later, please don't interrupt. But could this be because there is a demand in those communities? This gives a controlled environment at a pot shop as opposed to people selling on the street. Could there be an advantage to that?
What I'm saying is that's what's happening in Colorado. I want every community in Sacramento to thrive. And I'm going to go back to the same question. What, other than money, which this initiative is supported by private industry, not a government entity that's looking out for public policy and public health.
All right.
What is the good public policy?
We're going to take a break. We'll continue our conversation from the Guild Theater in Sacramento. It's California Counts, our statewide program looking at Proposition 64, legalizing marijuana. You hear the passion of our panelists. We'll continue with our conversation right after this.
Welcome back to the Guild Theater in Sacramento. I'm Beth Ruriak from Capital Public Radio. I'm here with Larry Mantle from KPCC Los Angeles. This is a special broadcast of California Counts, a collaboration of public radio stations across the state. We're bringing you comprehensive coverage of the 2016 election and California's role in it all. We've been talking in quite a lively and boisterous way about the pros and cons of legalizing marijuana in California for recreational use by adults. It's an issue voters will decide this fall when Proposition 64, the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, appears on the ballot. Rich Maddich wants to, let's address where we left off, but I think there have been a couple comments along the way. Rich is an attorney, helped draft the language for Prop 64. So what to you is the biggest misconception you've heard?
Well, I think, just taking a step back, I think we have heard, and we've heard this over the years, that while we have tremendous respect for law enforcement, for DA Schubert, the fact is they have traditionally opposed these types of efforts. And so to me, the real question is, do we perpetuate a system that allows today kids to access marijuana by drug dealers who aren't being regulated? They're accessing products that aren't being tested. And so the question is, do we perpetuate a system that does that, or do we try something new?
Is now, with their respect, opposition unfounded to you?
Their opposition is completely unfounded to me, and I just want to emphasize the effect on law enforcement. DA Schubert has said that there would essentially be no effect on law enforcement, that we're not solving a problem, but the legislative analyst is the state entity charged with determining what the fiscal effects of this initiative would be. They're nonpartisan. They have said tens of millions of dollars in annual savings. That's a fact. You can read it in the ballot pamphlet.
But I think that's some of her point, is that it is about money.
Exactly. It's right. But it's not about money.
This is not about money.
This is about creating a safe, regulated, controlled environment. Look, people are using marijuana today. Adults are using marijuana today. Children are accessing marijuana from drug dealers who are selling them products that aren't being tested. They aren't ID, obviously they aren't checking for ID. The kids are getting a hold of these products. We need a different system to protect the kids. We need a different system to protect the adults that want to use it in a responsible fashion. And we're using the same regulatory structure that the governor and a bipartisan support in our state legislature have approved.
Rich, if there wasn't a $1 billion analysis by the LAO's office on Prop 64, Would you have even written it? Would you be working as hard as you are to legalize?
Yes, absolutely. Look, again, people are using, it is a ubiquitous problem today. We need a new approach to it. The money, there will be, just like there is on the medical side, there is going to be a business aspect to this. But this is being driven by folks who are concerned about protecting kids and doing right by adults.
Lauren Michaels, California Police Chiefs Association, want to respond to that?
Sure. I completely agree. I think that law enforcement, though, our concerns are not unfounded. I think we have 332 police chiefs in California who are on the dance floors of their community who have significant concerns with Prop 64. And these are the same 332 police chiefs that co-sponsored the first consensus medical marijuana regulatory bill in California, SB 1262 in 2014, and continued those efforts last year as a co-sponsor of AB 266. So we're not on just say no group. But we are very concerned with the details of regulating medical marijuana, and we don't agree that this builds off of the consensus legislation from last year.
Does your group, looking at what's happened in Colorado, Washington, other states, think that other states have a better model, or do you think all the models are defective?
Well, we think California has a great model under the bill signed by the governor last year.
For just medical marijuana?
For medical marijuana and a platform to discuss adult use.
All right. Let's listen to another question from one of our listeners.
My name is Derek. I currently live in New Mexico. I'm a former resident of California. My question is, what would be the impact on groundwater use? And then, yes, one more question. So for those who grow indoors, what impact would that have on California's energy market?
Those questions to me say that people are coming at this issue from so many different angles. Mm-hmm. So Kimberly Cargile, as a cultivator, you also sit on the board of the California Growers Association. So why don't you take that question about groundwater?
Well, absolutely. So cultivators are regulated by a number of agencies under MCRSA and will also be regulated by a number of agencies under Proposition 64. Local governments will also regulate them, such as the City of Sacramento is asking to see energy efficiency plans and water recirculation plans. Indoor cultivations actually recirculate about 75% of their water and pull it directly back out of the air and reuse it. And we also, with solar panels and using energy off the at off times, we actually have a number of ways that we conserve energy. Cities and counties will actually regulate where these dispensaries and where these cultivations are. So they won't just show up anywhere. Every city and county will have their say, and so will the communities. But they are highly regulated, and as an industry, we do care about the environment, and we will have a number of laws that protect our environment.
Lauren Michaels, your thoughts on this, because we just heard about local regulations that can go above and beyond what Prop 64 calls for. How far do you think, how much latitude are cities going to have under this?
Sure, and to clarify, that authority exists under the medical marijuana laws as well. One of the differences we see under current law is that locals can ban indoor personal cultivation of cannabis. And under Prop 64, there's a prohibition on locals banning 6 plants per residence of cannabis. And there are questions about the water use and electricity use if we do have private residences being used to cultivate these 6 plants per residence.
6 plants would be enough to pose a drain on power?
I think so. If you look at the current estimates of 6 gallons of water per plant, which is up for debate, and you look at the amount of electricity per plant, which can be estimated as up to 19 refrigerators running.
Can I just pop in?
Yeah, Rich, then Peter. Yeah.
The answer to that concern, then, is that we actually do allow local governments to impose regulations to regulate how indoor personal grows are occurring. So if they want to limit the amount of water use or the electrical use, or if they want to require somebody to install certain types of electrical sockets to prevent fires, for example, local governments retain the authority to do that. So to the extent that's a concern, we actually provide a solution.
It would still seem, though, since you got the 6 plant guarantee, that could open up the door for legal challenges of cities that make it difficult to grow 6 plants.
Well, again, I think the initiative is pretty clear. You can't ban it outright, but you can regulate it. So as long as you're not making it completely impossible, you can certainly
Peter
regulate
Hecht.
Yeah, I'm going to try to jump in free of politics. I think it is amazing to comprehend what a massive sector of the economy this is in California, regardless about how you feel about the issue. You look at a UCLA study from 2011, estimated 3% of all California's electrical use was from marijuana growing, from indoor growing. You look at communities like Humboldt and Mendocino, obviously marijuana growing hotbeds. In 2007, statistics showed that in Mendocino County, per capita electrical use went up by 4 times the state average since the passage of Proposition 215. In Humboldt, it was 6 times the state average. So there was an incredible footprint to this, and we have enormous issues with water use, although there are widely disparate and conflicting figures on how much. There's this a figure thrown out, for example, 6 gallons per plant. Well, as many in the audience know, marijuana is grown in umpteen different ways, from outdoor plants, which could be the size of citrus trees, to very small indoor plants. Some of the smaller indoor plants may produce a few ounces per cycle. Some of the outdoor plants could produce 5, 6, 7 pounds in extreme cases. In between, you have these light deprivation greenhouses that produce a much more moderate levels. So it's very difficult to calculate, but there was enormous impact on electrical use, on water use, and if you look at the outdoor growths, particularly in environmentally sensitive areas, you have issues like grading and sediment and so forth. So what California is attempting to do, and with the Brown, the state regulations signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown, and now with the legalization initiative, has never been tried in any other state in the country, including Colorado and places like that, because California is pushing towards a wide-open cannabis economy in which anybody who wants to grow marijuana can conceivably access the market. That doesn't mean they're going to be able to, that they're not going to be logistically able to, or be able to obtain local permits. But what we're doing is far beyond what has ever been contemplated or undertaken in any state. And it is a major, major effort. It's already requiring enormous layers of regulation by the government. And it is an unfolding experiment. At the same time, and I'm kind of yammering on here, the black market is going to continue as people still can't access this market, and there is still a huge demand for marijuana out of state, where consumers in more restrictive areas will pay a premium for California marijuana.
What about the pitch, though, that legalizing will diffuse some of that black market? And would it disperse that concentration of energy and water use that was in Northern California, because now it will be legal to grow increasingly throughout the state?
Well, the more the economy is regulated, either through the existing medical marijuana regulations, which are really going to take up through 2018 before they're really going to take full effect, or through the Adult Use Act that the voters are going to decide on. That is going to empower a lot of state agencies, Department of Fish and Wildlife, water agencies, and so forth, to really get in and police this stuff. You're already starting to see inspections and water use and drainage and so forth. In terms of the black market, as long as there are states with more restrictive laws, you're going to have much higher price points. The other thing is, just because you're growing marijuana doesn't mean you're going to be able to access the regulated market, that you're going to get your product on dispensary shelves. That has to go someplace. There's going to be a black market for many years to come. Now, the RAND Corporation looked at this issue more from the interstate trafficking and basically said that it would have very little impact on Mexican cartels.
Joel Warner, real quickly, what have you seen is the price differential in Colorado between the underground market and the legal recreational market? Can you peg that difference?
Well, the issue is that prices are going down, and they're going down significantly. And we might even see the prices drop even more this coming fall. We start seeing the first of the large-scale outdoor grows in Colorado really kind of come to market. And theoretically, that's good for the consumer, right? They're paying less for this product. On the other hand, a lot of the mom-and-pop shops are going out of business, so they have to, are being bought up by the corporations. And also, there's the risk that that won't be able to, you know, fund all these services. And there's and this is a big issue here. You know, according to the California Growers Association, there are, 53,000 of these so-called craft cannabis farmers here in California. And yes, they are in places like Humboldt and Mendocino, where there are some significant environmental impacts. And yet these counties that have become dependent on this black market or gray market industry. And right now, at least, correct me if I'm wrong, the California Growers Association is remaining neutral.
And
you would think, well, this is the biggest grower association in the state, and they're remaining neutral. And one of the main reasons why is because 5 years after this goes into place, folks can apply for what's called an unlimited grow license. So basically, someone in, say, Central Valley can apply for a license that be able to grow acres upon acres of marijuana. On one hand, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's where we should have these large-scale grows that will have less impacts. But what happens to these counties and these small-scale farmers and these third-generation marijuana growers who have long been dependent on this.
Do Quick question, they all though. Go away? Kimberly, you are with the Growers Association. Is he accurate in why the Growers Association is no position?
I do sit on the board of the California Growers Association, and we are divided in our board membership on our feelings for a number of reasons. I think each of us has a different background, and there's a number of reasons that we're divided for personal reasons.
During the drafting process, we actually reached out to the Growers Association. In fact, our team actually went and visited folks up in Humboldt. And so we have a number of provisions that we incorporated at their request. First of all, it's not an unlimited cultivation license. It's a large-scale cultivation license, which there is no guarantee that those will ever be issued. They can't be issued at all, we know, for the first 5 years. And then if they're issued at the discretion of the regulators after 5 years, they're subject to the same restrictions on vertical integration that Lauren mentioned as a model in the medical legislation.
What's though to keep out, you know, big tobacco or large scale operations from driving everyone else out through economies of scale?
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, the licenses are only a 1 year license. And when licensing agencies go to issue those licenses, the initiative directs them to consider things like, would issuance of this license create a potential monopoly? Would it lead to anti-competitive behavior? And if the regulators see that type of behavior in the market, they are given the tools to deny the license. So we were very cognizant of that being one of the potential harms that people were concerned with, and we addressed it directly.
Okay, Lauren Michaels, NOAA 64, quick response to that.
Sure, I think one of the things missing from the initiative that we have in the medical marijuana bills is a restriction on the number of licenses that you can apply for. And what could potentially happen under the initiative is that prior to the 5-year introduction of the Type 5 license types, people apply for multiple of the medium cultivation licenses.
I think we're just about at the end here. I'd like to hear from everybody one more time, but it's got to be something really quick. So I want a thought or a sentence from each of you describing what it means if Prop 64 does pass in California. And I'm going to start with Sacramento County DA Anne Marie Schubert. If it passes, one sentence.
One sentence is, go back to what Joel said, is what's the long-term impact that we're going to see on kids, our schools, our neighborhoods, and we don't have the studies to show that.
Lauren Michaels.
If it passes, I think we'll see two conflicting regulatory structures being implemented at the same time with a lot of regulatory confusion and chaos at the Capitol.
Joel Warner.
I think if it passes, you're going to see winners and losers. Who are the winners going to be? As a journalist, you have to follow the money.
Yeah.
Peter Hecht.
And some people are going to make a lot and some not so much. If you want to know what the impact's going to be, look what's happening right now. The regulation initiative is not something dramatically new. It is a continuation of what we're seeing with the largest marijuana market on the planet, and that's what exists in the medical marijuana economy right now. So look what's happening now if you want to predict the future.
Kimberly Cargile.
There is a large industry in California that's been built over the last 20 years of a legal industry and a much larger industry that's been built over the last 50 years. There are many people in this state, thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands. We have 20,000 patients that use cannabis, and they deserve to have laws that they understand. They deserve to have regulated products. They deserve to have lab-tested products.
I'm going to stop you there, so the last word goes to Rich Manich.
If passed, we will have, finally, a comprehensive structure to regulate, control, and tax adult-use marijuana and protect kids.
Beth, it's been a pleasure working with you here in your hometown. Larry Mantle with Beth Ruyak. You've been listening to a statewide town hall, California Counts, debating Prop 64, the November initiative that would legalize recreational marijuana. We've come your way from the Guild Theater in Sacramento. California Counts is a comprehensive state election collaboration between KPBS San Diego, KPCC Los Angeles, KQED San Francisco, and Capital Public Radio Sacramento. Our producers are Capital Public Radio's Jen Picard and KPCC's Matt D'Angelo Antonio. Our engineers are Dave McKeever and Mark Jones. Special thanks to Capital Public Radio's Insight and Digital teams and KPCC's in-person crew. On next month's California Counts Town Hall, we'll come your way from San Diego. We'll debate Proposition 62, a proposed repeal of the death penalty. Thanks to you so much for joining us from the Guild Theater.